While I am not denying the appeal of a good hard-boiled egg, I for one am more partial to the luxuries of the modern world, like freshly roasted coffee delivered right to your door. You know I'm talking about Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home, office, or man-sized fish tank in a mysterious government facility within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The promotion doesn't apply to any of the great gear that Sparkplug carries, but it applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
How about eggs in the coffee?
That's a breakfast to go.
Bacon? You can boil the egg before the coffee's actually made.
Boil the egg in the coffee.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Solutions.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hola and gracias para descargando. That's probably not right, but it's close enough. To the next 116 project, the almost every Monday classic movies podcast. If you would like to hear about the AFI's 123 great movies, then you can dig into our archives and you'll find reviews of all of them. And since we finished that job many years ago, now we review an assortment of pictures that interests us. Today we kick off Movies We Hate Month. To paraphrase Peter O'Toole's food critic and Bev's beloved, behated, Ratatouille, negative reviews are generally more fun to deliver and to listen to. That's not a good impression, is it? So we're going to give you 3 straight weeks of movie bashing. And we'll be spoiling all of these 3 movies, and of course, we always spoil movies anyway. I'm the egg eater who practices self-love in the tub, Ryan Ellis, and here's the aquatic creature with magical healing powers and a hidden dick, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, The Shape of Water, the 2017 Best Picture winner. Not really a movie we hate, but we wanted to cover it because it sort of fits this MO of this month, and we're doing it first rather than last, which is what we originally wanted to do because we found it at the library. Anyway, so not really a movie we hate. We'll explain that as we go along. So the coming attractions trivia for Shape of Water. It says online that this is the only sci-fi movie to win Best Picture, and that it is, but it's really more of a fantasy film. What's the only other movie you could reasonably call fantasy that won Best Picture?
Kind of a softball.
It was.
Lord of the Rings, Return of the King.
Indeed.
And I agree with you, there's not that much science in it unless you count a cattle prod. They aren't really performing good science on the creature, they just found him. It is a fantasy.
I think the creature being sci-fi, that's what they're going for.
The not
Amphibian
my definition.
Man, by the way. That's what it says on IMDb, the Amphibian Man.
Yeah, there's lots of different names for him. He's the asset, he's the creature, the Amphibian Man.
All right, Fox Searchlight sicked the fish fucker on a lot of festivals, including the Toronto International Film Festival. And then the movie started eking out right around Christmas just last year. Considering the small budget, the flick made a nice chunk of bucks, especially when you look at the near $200 million worldwide gross. And by the way, for Best Picture winners, this is the first real bona fide success that won the award since Argo. The ones since haven't really been successes in any big way.
As in they haven't made a lot of money.
Spotlight, Moonlight did fine, but they weren't hits. This was worldwide, pretty big hit. Okay, Bev, this movie's only a few months old and people probably saw it, but explain it for them anyway with the skinny...
Sally Hawkins is Eliza, a mute cleaning woman in Baltimore in 1962 who works at a secret government facility bent on giving the Americans an advantage in the space race. That advantage, for some reason, is breathing through gills. So they kidnap a mysterious amphibious swamp creature from South America to study. Eliza, armed with hard-boiled eggs and a low profile, frees the creature with the help of her friends and aims to set it free as long as she can stay ahead of her evil boss, who needs to get the creature back so he can keep buying Cadillacs. Oh, also, Eliza has sex with the fishman.
And his hidden dick.
And his hidden dick.
Or, in a nutshell, Splash without Hanks. That's what I called it when we did the Oscars show a couple months ago, and it remains that. It is Splash without Hanks. People have asked, if the creature was female and Eliza was a guy, would it be cool? Would it be okay if you did the same storyline? Well, Splash is the same storyline. It's just a comedy, and she talks, and the creature doesn't talk. Otherwise, it's the same basic movie.
Daryl Hannah is a lot prettier than this creature. When I won the Best Picture, I think I tweeted that it was E.T. if E.T. could fuck.
That is one of the influences for sure, yeah. Including having the healing powers.
Well, that's the thing, is that E.T. could heal.
And they got to get him home.
Yeah, and they're fighting against the government to protect... Yeah, there's a lot in common with E.T.
And
except
both,
for the fuck.
And both die and come back to life.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
So Rotten Tomatoes numbers on The Shape of Water are very strong, which is interesting considering we're doing it in Movies We Hate Month. 92% of critics like the movie. 322 fresh reviews, only 28 rotten. But 73% of audiences, which is still pretty solid and certainly better than what we would say. By the way, we're including in this month, but if you were to say 3 stars out of 4, thumbs up, whatever criteria you want to use, is it that or is it a thumbs down or 2 stars out of 4? What would it be for you?
I agree. It's like probably 3 out of 4 stars. If it hadn't have won Best Picture, I would have just been mildly disappointed and then never thought about it again. There's plenty to enjoy about it, but it just as a whole didn't succeed for me. And I know that's a dissenting opinion. I can see what Del Toro was trying to do. But in my opinion, he's trying to do way too much. Just because your story takes place in the early 60s doesn't mean you're obligated to address every single issue that needed addressing back then. The second half seems to find its footing, but not before the film fails for me in the one most vital way, and that is that it never convinces me that Eliza and the creature are in love. I don't understand their romance in any way other than it needs to happen to have the plot make sense. And without that component, nothing that happens in the second half bears any emotional weight for me.
When we went to see this late last year, friends of yours said, bring tissues, meaning you're going to cry.
Yes.
Or maybe you're supposed to jerk off the movie. I don't know. Or I was.
Fish dick.
It was pretty sexy. But no, they implied you were going to cry. I've cried at movies plenty of times. Not usually the first time I see them. You certainly cried at movies.
Oh, yeah.
First,
second, anytime.
Yeah. Neither of us was even close to tears. And I think that's the main reason why, because we didn't buy the romance. And the two biggest problems with the movie, even though one of them is a beautiful looking scene, the first time I saw the movie, I felt this way. The second time I felt this way, and thinking about it now, I feel the same way all over again. The scene in the bathroom, when they flood it so he can be in his watery element. They destroy the theater beneath her place, which, by the way, has big audio bleed early on, so she must hear every movie.
Aren't you trying to keep a low profile, lady? Yeah.
And you could argue that it's supposed to be a fantasy thing, but then along comes Giles to open up the door and all the water comes out. That wouldn't work logistically, and I know it's supposed to be a fantasy type of thing, but you're making it seem real by having Giles open the door. If he doesn't do that and you just cut to some other scene, I think it's fantasy, and then it maybe works. But it's just so stupid and selfish to do that. You've ruined this guy's apartment, the guy who owns the building.
And if you think if there's one person in the world that would respect water damage and just what a total mess she's making, it would be a cleaning woman. She knows a thing or two about what it takes to clean up after an enormous mess. Gonna ruin the apartment, certainly ruin plenty of things that she owns. I know it sounds nitpicky. I think it's just like another thing
but
that
it's important.
If we bought the romance, then we would just be caught up
in it. You know why
it's
important? The poster shot is the last shot, or one of the last shots of the movie, when they're kissing in the, now, ocean,
the reservoir,
I guess. And they're going to go off just like the end of Splash, and she's now got gills that come to life, so she's going to live on, even though she should be dead from a gunshot wound, but okay, he brought her back to life. So that's why you have that earlier scene, and it plays off that. And everyone else who cries and Natalie says, that's so beautiful, you guys are wrong, and you're being assholes. But if it's a stupid moment early on, then the last shot doesn't mean anything. And it's also going into sci-fi elements that, like we say, aren't really there until they need to be there. The creature can put the hair back in Giles's head. Okay, I'll give you that, I guess. But it doesn't really have any other magical powers until it brings her back to life, brings itself back to life, and she can survive underwater because she's being shot. And even let's just go back to a smaller point, the fact that she and Zelda have such access to this top secret facility. Okay, maybe they have to clean it once in a while, I grant you that, but they should be under strict guard the whole time because they're nobodies. They're not given proper access to that, and she's in there by herself more than once.
They're given access because they're nobodies. I actually thought this was kind of a cool theme of the movie, the overlooked and the advantage of invisibility. Eliza and Zelda are quote-unquote invisible people, a black woman and a mute spinster. That's why they see these things they're not supposed to see, because people habitually forget they're even there. Strickland even says, in one of the many obvious dialogue points in the film, I'll nitpick that more later, but Strickland even says,
that's Michael Shannon.
Investigating them is a waste of time. They're just the cleaning staff. They couldn't possibly get the best of him. And I think that's actually one of the themes of the film that is well wrought.
But Eliza spends so much time on her own with the creature, though, too. Okay, she has time in there once in a while, but she's in there quite often. Now, she is hiding one time from, I guess it's Hofstetler, who's a double agent, another element in this movie.
Well, she's hiding because she would otherwise get caught bringing hard-boiled eggs.
No, I know, but the fact that she's in there as much as she is, I just didn't really buy that anyway. So we are being really nitpicky, but if you can't buy the central concepts, and I agree with you, too, that just the overarching theme of the shape of water, according to Del Toro, means love.
Yeah.
There is no shape of love. There's no shape of water. But if you can't buy that these two creatures, one of them is a creature, are in love with each other, then the movie falls apart. So if we say we give it 3 stars, it's for the design, it's for Del Toro's direction, just for the second half. Ironically, a lot of movies, so many movies, are way better than the first half, or maybe the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
George Lucas said that about movies. Have a great opening, have a great closing, and what happens in the middle doesn't matter. He meant that about Star Wars. Most fans would say the whole movie's great, but the best parts of Star Wars probably are the opening and the closing. This one actually gets better as it goes along, if anything. But then you also have to be dragged along by the fact that I don't know if I really am into this. And also Richard Jenkins as Giles, who's usually a great actor, one of the great character actors. There's so many good character actors. I've talked about that a lot lately. You could kill off half of Hollywood and still have a ton of character actors you could choose from to be in, or even to be stars now to fill the void. But for a guy who's been so good and who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, he's a little shticky.
So this is a very dissenting opinion because people went nuts for his performance.
I liked it the first time, didn't like it as much this time.
Okay, because I agree with you. I think Sally Hawkins is wonderful.
She's great.
She comes the closest that anything comes to making this movie work for me.
And Doug Jones does a good job in the creature role, as he always does for Del Toro when he plays a creature for Del Toro.
Yeah, but I'm with you. I don't think that Richard Jenkins was that special. Like, he didn't really bother me, but I found his character, and Zelda too, to an extent, they're there, and it's good that they're Eliza's friends, they're her family, they're her world. They perform very much the role of speaking on Eliza's behalf.
Because she can,
so much that it seems phony. If you had a new friend and you can understand sign language, you wouldn't actually repeat everything they say.
Maybe once in a while,
it's a little corny. And I think the movie probably would have worked better if they had taken advantage of her performance, like a silent performance. Mm. Del Toro had asked her to study the silent greats like Chaplin and Buster Keaton, and I would have loved to see that play itself out and have more showing and less telling. You've given us a mute character. Why aren't you taking advantage of that? Why do you take every opportunity you have for somebody to say out loud her thoughts? And that's very much what Jenkins is doing. And he's also just this impossibly sympathetic character. I guess I'm being hard on it just because my cold dead heart really kicked in this film, because nothing really worked on me. Whenever I'm watching a film and they're like, this character is wronged, he's pitiable, feel sorry for him, it was so broadcast from the rafters, it makes me turn against it. So he's gay and he has a crush on a waiter who's way out of his league, and if the waiter was gay. Anyway, he wears this embarrassing toupee and hits on him, and I'm not really upset for him that he gets rejected, because everything he does makes no sense from somebody who's trying to protect his own feelings. And then the movie has to, like, even kick it into overdrive and make that waiter racist, too.
Immediately after he gets mad at Jenkins.
Give me a break.
You get out of here. You don't belong here anymore. Gay guy. I didn't say that, but that's what he means. And then right after that, the black couple comes in and they get kicked out, too.
When a filmmaker sets a film in the late 50s, early 60s, it's like Hollywood's second favorite time to set a movie in after World War II, because, you know, World War II is number one. But I guess it's because it's the other time in memorable history that there was a clear moral line drawn in the sand, and we've all collectively decided what was right and
not
what
all.
Was wrong back then.
Not all.
Okay. And we all get to feel smug about our contemporary liberal values. And The Shape of Water isn't remotely subtle about what side of history it lands on. And the guy at the pie counter is this perfect example of laying it on 3 times thicker than you need to, and in a way kind of insulting our intelligence. I'll say what I said in Pleasantville. It's not brave to take a stance against racism or homophobia in 2018. But people just love going to a movie to feel like, I would have stood up to that back then. I never would have put up with that. I'm so much better than these characters. It makes us all feel better about ourselves. But I find it heavy-handed and corny.
I like that scene more the first time I saw it. This time, I thought it was badly done, especially the counter guy, because he was too far over the top. Del Toro's a great director, but he didn't direct that scene very well. But as far as taking issues in the 60s issues, or really any era, this cast, very deliberately, the main characters, the four of them, are outsiders. The mute woman alone, but the fact she can't speak.
And unmarried as well.
Sure, right. And a job that no one respects or cares about. The weird foreigner, which is the amphibian man. The black woman. The homosexual artist. Not just an artist, but a homosexual. And older, for that matter, so older people don't count. And Akami, the Michael Stuhlbarg character. This is one of his three Best Picture nominees he was in last year, along with Call Me By Your Name and The Post.
Yeah, he had a great 2017, that guy.
But I've been picking up a lot of people who were in multiple Best Picture nominees last year. Just, I found out today, the girl in Blockers, Leslie Mann's daughter, was in Three Billboards and Lady Bird. Timothée Chalamet was in Call Me By Your Name and
Lady Bird.
So anyway, a lot of people.
And that other guy who was in both Three Billboards and Get Out.
Caleb Landry Jones.
Yeah, I never remember his name. You always do.
If we ever do Call Me By Your Name, we'll talk about this a lot more extensively. Michael Stuhlbarg, that scene he has with his son towards the end, where he talks about knowing what was going on, you're bisexual, you're gay. That's really stuck with me. I don't remember specifically what he said, because I only saw the scene once. But when I watched that movie again, I think I might put it on my list of great scenes. So all those people are outsiders, and it's a very deliberate touch, clearly. I wonder if the success of this movie, these non-traditional heroic characters, is a Trump lash. Much like Moonlight, which won Best Picture only months after Dork Boy, that's being nice, isn't it, won the presidency, That was an all-black cast.
And gay and poor.
Right. So I wonder if the last two choices for Best Picture, some people might say Moonlight was underwhelming. We agree that Shape of Water is at least somewhat underwhelming. And maybe they're both winning partly politically because of the political leader of their country.
I think Moonlight was the best.
I agree, it was a great movie. But I wonder if it won. It's surprising that
it won, considering the juggernaut that was La La Land.
Because La La Land, The Artist wasn't that many years ago, Argo, Shape of Water are all movies about movies. Hollywood loves to make movies about movies. I love to watch movies about movies, and often they're rewarded at the Oscars with either some awards or all the big ones. Bad and the Beautiful won a lot of awards way back in 52. It didn't win everything. It didn't win Best Picture, but it won, I think, 5. That was a movie about movie making. Yeah.
They like to see themselves.
And by the way, I didn't say this way back when, but the movie was 46th at the 2017 U.S. box office. Last Jedi, of course, was number one. Even though that movie wasn't really all that respected by a lot of fans, Last Jedi, it was a very big success. 4 Disney movies, in fact, were in the top 10 last year. We're going to say that forever, especially now that they have Fox.
It's a matter of time before Disney owns everything, so...
Now, as far as the rating, because this movie is rated R, Del Toro, again, earns that R like he did with Pan's Labyrinth, although that was even more bloody and violent and gory. And rough. But you got the nudity, you got sex, and you got ugly violence in both movies. But this is Pan's Labyrinth in America. The hero girl is shot and quote-unquote dies. Yeah. And this one, she comes back to life, or does she? In Pan's Labyrinth, she lives on, but she dies in our real world. The villain is killed, horrifically, and it's got a bittersweet ending. Both of them do. You can read it however you want to. Is it actually happy, or is it not?
They both have a villain who, while consummately evil in every way, is completely convinced that they're doing the right thing and that they are on the right side. They think they are the good guys.
And I think the guy in Pan's Labyrinth is definitely... Sergi Lopez, that's his name, is the better... Michael Shannon is the better known actor. You've never been a fan of his. I've liked him sometimes, but Michael Shannon does what Michael Shannon does, which is be so intense!
Dude.
And Sergi Lopez in Pan's Labyrinth, I've never seen him before, so I have nothing to compare it to. Is one of the great villains of the last 20 years.
He builds up to intensity. By the end of the film, he's very intense. In Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah. Whereas Strickland just starts off with that scene where he's bullying them in the bathroom and peeing in front of Zelda and Eliza, where they're chatting so enjoyably. A line that I swear to God has got to be an homage to Dr. Strangelove.
This movie's set in 1962, so you can't literally say it was about Strangelove, because Strangelove is 64.
Cold War II.
This is also set in Baltimore, by the way. The same year, 1962, and the setting is Hairspray, which we reviewed just last year.
Oh.
Also about racial issues. And
you could
that
do
movie,
like a cross cut of the two movies taking place at the same time.
And that movie, the black people are allowed to matter and they start counting. This one, maybe not so much. Anyway, back to your point.
Yeah, so to me, Michael Shannon's overkill performance is the worst offense of the film. His character altogether, because I know it's not just all his fault, the way it's written... His performance, I mean, come on, man. And the side plot of his home life.
I like that.
In a different movie, I think I would actually love it.
He'd be too cardboard if we didn't have some of those things.
But it's not even real. It's this total tonal shift. I just don't buy it. I guess his wife is happy and horny because she has a suburban home. Okay.
I think the movie's saying he's a different person when he's at home, because a lot of men or women... when they're at work, or a whole different person than they are when they go home.
He doesn't seem different. Does he seem different to you? When they're having sex and he's putting his bloody hand over her mouth to shut her up?
Which is awful, but a really important scene, because it seems to suggest that he wants his wife to shut the fuck up. Well, he does, obviously.
Yeah.
And is he envisioning Eliza at that point? Because he's still on her side. He doesn't dislike her till later in the
film. But he's not sweet to her. Not by any measure.
No, but it's almost like he's horny and he wishes that was Eliza underneath him, even though his wife is better looking than Eliza.
Okay, but that whole scene and his whole home life, even Cadillac shopping, it all totally doesn't fit with the rest of the film. You have to agree that it feels like it belongs in a different movie.
I think that's why it's there. I think that actually works. I don't love the performance either, but I think that in a lot of ways works because it's this whole different life this guy has. He's buying this Cadillac that he doesn't even like because it's what he likes, obviously, but he buys a green car. He didn't want a green car.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of green in this movie, too.
Yes, but he wants a status symbol. He really cares deeply about appearing successful.
He's got the two kids as well.
And I get that they set it up that it's the early 60s. He's living the suburban American dream. He has done everything right. He's been good at his job. He doesn't ask questions. And he's been rewarded with his wife and his two kids and his suburban home and his Cadillac. That, as a motivation for him, like everything else in the movie, is laid on a little too thick. We'll have to agree to disagree about the home life scenes. I like it as a theme that they explore, that that's his motivation.
You think they don't execute it then?
Yeah, I don't think they execute it all that well. And his performance is... Come on with the mustache-twisting villain. He's already so evil. Everything he does is evil. And just when you think you can't take one more frame of it, he goes full Weinstein on Eliza in that fishbowl of an office. We get it.
And the disgusting fingers, which of course isn't what you're talking about right now, but that's a memorable part. That's, I guess, a play on Sergio Lopez having his face cut open and having to sew it shut. The ooh factor from the audience when the villain really gets treated badly, deservedly so. Because obviously the creature bit the fingers off. We did see it happen, but that's what did happen.
Which is great, because the first time we meet Strickland, he's bullying the girls in the washroom. And then the very next time we see him, he's stumbling out of the room with his fingers missing.
Because he was bullying the creature.
So he goes from him at his strongest, feeling as bold as he ever does, to him at his weakest. So I actually thought that was a nice touch. There's lots of things to like about the movie. I hope we make that clear that there's plenty of things that do work.
He has a really tough boss, though, too. The general, Nick Searcy, who is the best friend of Tom Hanks in Castaway. Now he's playing this real badass character. Get results or you're fired, or whatever he says to him. In other words, you're going to be punished if you don't come through.
And he's not, you won't just be fired. You'll be nobody.
Right, so he has motivation. So you say what you said about him, but don't forget, the general is the real problem here because he's treating him like he doesn't count. That's not cool to treat other people like they don't count. But anyway, he's given some motivations. And by the way, Nick Searcy was in Three Billboards.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they shot this whole movie in Canada, which I did not know until the Oscars when Del Toro talked about it in one of his speeches as the best director or best picture.
They shot most of it in my hometown of Hamilton.
My hometown of Hamilton. They shot it there. I did not know that. They showed some of it. I forget where the little clips were shown, and I feel like I recognize some things because they digitally remove things, landmarks and whatnot in Hamilton and Toronto. And you think, oh, when it's that, oh, now I get it. I recognize where they are. And the TIFF premiere of the movie itself was at the Elgin Theatre here in Toronto. And the interiors of the movie theatre they use underneath Eliza's apartment are the Elgin.
That would have been so cool, sitting in that theatre seeing the movie like that. I am not immune to the warm, fuzzy feelings that I got from all the outpouring of praise that came first with his Oscar speech and then my Facebook feed. Because I have a lot of friends who either work in the film industry or periphery to the film industry because, you know, we both work in television in Toronto. And there was a lot of outpouring of love for Toronto film crews and the Toronto film business, and it did warm my heart, I'm not going to deny.
And also Guillermo del Toro won an Oscar, and that's great because everybody likes him. We like him.
He won it for the wrong movie, but I'm not unhappy that Guillermo del Toro has an Oscar.
Scorsese's win is not quite as bad because The Departed is a good movie. It's just not one of Scorsese's two or three best, or maybe even five best. But for del Toro, who hasn't made that many movies, this isn't in his top three, I wouldn't say. And I guess I keep saying, Pan's Labyrinth, he's cribbing from his own movie, and that's the better movie. It wasn't even nominated for Best Picture, and that was the same year as The Departed, actually, ironically. But one of the best moments of the Oscars in a long time, and actually the year before when that envelope snafu happened, what happened from all that? I've watched that on YouTube so many times. So in a way, that's a great moment too, even though they got the fucking envelope wrong and announced the wrong winner.
I loved that.
But I've seen it so many times and it's really sweet. I love Jordan Horowitz. I've talked about that before.
Yeah. Oh, but I love that they brought them back to give away Best Picture again.
Yeah, Dunaway and Beatty. But no, my favorite moment of the Oscars this year from last year's movies was Del Toro looking at Best Picture envelope and gives this great Muppet face. Yeah, it's the right one.
He's that so was cute. So cute. He's so lovely.
So we can't begrudge him winning two awards, Best Picture, Best Director. And now he's got an Oscars like his buddies do. Alfonso Cuarón won Best Director for Gravity. And Alejandro González Iñárritu has four because he won three for Birdman and one for The Revenant. So these guys who were buddies a long time ago, and in 2006 when Pan's Labyrinth came out and Children of Men came out, which we reviewed a couple years ago, and Babel, those guys were all on Charlie Rose and you could tell they were buddies and it was clear they've all referenced each other in their Oscar speeches. I predicted that in the Oscars preview show this year, that if Del Toro won, he was going to mention Cuarón and Iñárritu, and he did, and they talked about the other two guys and their speeches, so all those things are wonderful. And it's also interesting, speaking of the Oscars, we usually save this for the end, but I'll just go over them right now. It won the big ones, picture and director, which I don't think really surprised that many people, but it only won two others, music and the sets. Not exactly major ones, not like script or actress. It was nominated for 9 more, because I think it had the most this year, right? Best actress, best supporting actor, supporting actress as well, where Octavia Spencer is giving the same performance she did in The Help with a little less sass.
Yeah.
The script, the editing, the cinematography, the sound effects, and the costumes. It didn't win any of those 9, but it did win picture, director, music, and sets.
I love Octavia Spencer. I feel like I could watch her do anything. I wish that Hollywood would give her a great leading role, but it really is as though Del Toro took Minnie from The Help and placed her in a scientific facility working towards putting a man in space from Hidden Figures, put them together. Nothing else really creative or interesting came from her part, and like the character of Giles, she's halfway there to just speak for Eliza and provide exposition as well that Eliza can't because she can't speak. Not very gracefully either, in my opinion.
I wasn't a fan of The Help. I thought it was overwrought, as Woody Allen would say.
I'm with you.
Not very good. Including that stupid end song. Although the actors were all very good in the film, especially Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer. And Spencer, of course, won supporting actress, and that's wonderful. But she's played the same character, whether it's her fault or the people that cast her, probably 3 times now. Hidden Figures is a little different, and this isn't.
Mm.
So it's not bad. It's just you've done this before, so I'm not mad at her. But stop giving her the same fucking role.
We've
give her
seen
something
her
different.
Do other things. Think
that
she's
tiny
just
role
typecast.
In Bad Santa. Willie, I didn't shit right for a week. She's more memorable in that than she will be in this long term.
Yeah.
And by the way, I talked about the Oscars. Will this movie be thought of in 5 or 10 or certainly 20 years? The way that, well, maybe not Spotlight or even Moonlight either, for that matter.
It's just
or.
Gonna get...
Argo or The Artist?
No, it's so true. I think it's just going to get boiled down to being called the fish-fucking movie, which is already all anybody calls it.
I thought that was my thing.
The fish-fucking movie?
Yeah.
No, sir, a lot of other people thought of that.
Okay. That should be my thing. All right, another big issue in the film is the double agent thing, the commie, Hofstadter, Stuhlbarg's character. There were double agents in important positions in the U.S. government. That was absolutely true. So as much as Joe McCarthy was a fucking awful person, he wasn't entirely wrong. It's just that he went about the wrong way. And of course, trying to ruin people in Hollywood is not really the point. The Russians want Hofstadter to kill the creature, though, rather than let the Americans have it. And the Americans would have done the same with the Russians, probably, either in reality or if it had been a movie made by the Russians. So I get that. That's kind of a typical thing. And Stuhlbarg gives a good performance, but that was an element... Well, I guess it's not unnecessary, is it? Because it is about the space race, and this creature, like you said in your skinny, is the connection there.
I know, how are Gil's going to help you in space?
But what did you think of his performance and his role? And...
Oh, you know, he's my favorite character in the film. I found it refreshing to see a take on the Red Scare, where the Russian agent is running up against the same bureaucratic cruelty as the American characters, and his loyalties aren't split between democracy and communism. His loyalties are split between his love and loyalty of country and his duty and what he considers doing the right thing for the creature.
Which he does.
Yeah. It wasn't just the cliche Russian agent story, and I thought that his character had like a really lovely depth, and he's such a lovable man. He kind of has this dad quality where you immediately feel warmth towards any character he's playing, and that's probably why he gets cast in these roles, because it's almost like a shorthand. You just see him and you feel like he's safe and warm and you can relate to him.
I think if Call Me By Your Name really sticks with people or sticks with us as the years go on, whenever we see it again, we might be looking back and saying that, or even this, he could have been nominated or should have been nominated for a supporting actor. Almost like it represents all the movies he made that year, because I don't remember him so much in The Post, but he was in that. Best Picture nominee.
Wasn't in The Post?
All right, but still, 3 Best Picture nominees that year. Not that he's entitled to an Oscar nomination for those, but he was great in Call Me By Your Name, and he is good in this film, you're right. Now, one thing that also doesn't work very well, we didn't talk about this with the flooded bathroom or the end or the creature and the woman falling up in the first place, but the dance sequence. And it's nice, it's well done. Again, I love movies, Del Toro is telling us he loves movies, and that's great. But we already know they're in love. It's a time waster. And one of the bigger problems in the whole thing, maybe the biggest problem in this whole sequence, is that she speaks. I remember a critic pointed out that when Jamie Foxx has a dream sequence in Ray, he can see. But of course, he's been blind since he was a kid, and that took this critic out of the film. It didn't really bother me so much, but when I saw the movie after reading that review, I thought, I guess I have to agree with that. Maybe you shouldn't have gone down that road. You can buy it being a fantasy thing, just like in this movie with the dancing, but it ruins it in a way, because why did we ever hear this voice? We should never hear Eliza's voice.
Also, her having a big Hollywood fantasy didn't really read for me, because she's not the one who's obsessed with Hollywood films. It's Giles. It seems more like she's humoring him when she watches these movies with him.
And he's not with her when she's doing this. It's just her and the creature.
And she looks like she's happy that she can go see a movie when her landlord or whatever is like, oh, I'm going to let you in for free. But we never see her enjoying a movie once. So it's another left turn that the movie takes. like you say, it's a time waster. It was pretty, I suppose. I feel like I've seen better. I think La La Land did a very similar thing. I think they were doing an homage to Singing in the Rain, definitely. Sort of. Yeah, and they did this beautiful fantasy sequence, which is one of the best things I saw that year.
Where they float off into the sky?
No, at the end, when they do their whole love story. Oh, that. It was so beautiful.
Fantasy, but realistic, because, of course, the sequence in this movie is not going to happen.
It's complete
the
fantasy,
creature
yeah.
can't dance with her.
But when you have that as a standard that you're holding it up to, and then you see this, you're like, yeah, it's fine, I guess. If I was super nostalgic for old movies from back then, it would have affected me more, but yeah, it didn't seem that special, and I agree with you that I didn't need to see her sing. I didn't need to have it implied that she felt like being mute was such a shortcoming in her life. Because they actually portray her at the beginning of the film as being a pretty happy person.
She's boiling her eggs, she's masturbating before she even meets
She goes and sees Giles, they have this beautiful friendship, she spends her nights with Zelda, they have this beautiful friendship. She doesn't seem like somebody who's lacking so much that they... It seems like she projects this romance on this fish man who has no personality to speak of. Something else that kind of bothers me is, what does she love about him exactly? He's different and she feels sorry for him. I totally buy that. But he really doesn't reveal much in the way of intelligence. We just make assumptions based on Eliza's reaction. He's mostly a blank slate. We don't learn anything about him. Is he a god? He heals and comes back from the dead. Until he heals Giles' hair loss, we don't see him do anything endearing or lovable. There's this famous screenwriting handbook you probably are familiar with called Save the Cat, which instructs writers to give their heroes some way to perform their goodness in the first act of the film so that the audience feels safe rooting for them. Well, it takes forever to have a reason to root for the creature, and in between our time of meeting them and realizing that he's someone worthwhile, he literally eats a cat. And everybody gets over it.
Kill the cat, then.
Immediately. Mm. He eats a house cat.
So he turns into Alf.
Alf never turned around with cat blood all over his face.
He wanted to.
I know. It's weird.
Yeah, and it's too bad that we're criticizing Doug Jones because he's done so well in so many of these movies for Del Toro. Abe Sapien in Hellboy, The Pale Man, and The Fawn in Pan's Labyrinth. Great character in those. Abe Sapien at least can speak, and so can the Fawn, although it's all Spanish, so it's a little harder for us to truly connect. Jenkins, who we've criticized plenty in this, also has the narrator role, which I think is only the very beginning and the very ending.
Yeah, he bookends it.
Which isn't his fault. That's Del Toro and his co-writer, Vanessa Taylor, who is a writer-producer on Game of Thrones. Del Toro usually writes his own movies or co-writes them, and he did in this case as well. He was a triple threat, just like Iñárritu was with, what, two movies in a row? I think it was both The Revenant, and certainly was for Birdman, and Cuarón maybe have been at least a double threat in some of his movies, and Del Toro usually writes, directs, and produces. Sally Hawkins, the character, of course, is Eliza. Eliza Doolittle, Pygmalion. Bit of a comparison there.
Well, considering Eliza Doolittle, it's all about her speech. That's what gives her away. That's what makes her an outsider, is that she can't speak eloquently.
And I guess Giles is her... What's his name again? The main character in that. Rex Harrison. Higgins, right.
I'm going to say no. I don't really see very many similarities between the two characters.
I think I read that somewhere. Maybe it's because I saw Liza and compared the two names. But anyway, that may be what it was. Again, we're looking at a guy who loves to homage old movies. Eliza. And for Sally Hawkins, this role was written for her.
Yeah,
Del Toro wanted her and only her. I don't know if he would have said no movie period if she'd said no, but he wanted her. She's been good in plenty of things. Mike Leigh film, she was in Blue Jasmine, got a supporting actress nomination out of that. And she's also going to be in the Godzilla sequel, and she's one of only two actors. I think the other one is, what's his name again, Ken Watanabe, I think that's it, who's going to be in the sequel, who was in the original. Rest of the cast, well, fuck them, they're not coming back. Just the scientists. Now, we agree she gives a good performance, right? And she's the second woman in a row, one of our podcasts, who masturbates in the bathtub because, of course, Pleasantville, which we did 2 weeks ago, has Joan Allen doing that. This is more graphic. We don't see Joan Allen's boobs. We do see Sally Hawkins a couple times.
It doesn't look so much romantic as it looks actually strikingly realistic. She is the one thing that comes the closest to making the movie work for me.
And also Spielberg.
I did love him, too. He's less important in the overall film, but because she's the lead actress, her emoting is so beautiful.
And she doesn't overdo it, either.
No, she doesn't. It feels very believable. The first time we saw the film, I think you took a washroom break, and you came back, and then after we saw it, you said, what did I miss? Because it feels like she goes from being curious and having compassion for the creature to suddenly being in love with him, and you're like, what scene did I miss? You didn't miss a scene. Because it feels like there's a scene missing. It's just like
we all missed the scene, not just me.
Yeah. Del Toro was just like, no, Sally can take it from here. She can just do all the heavy lifting and convince us that for some reason she's actually romantically in love with what is, for all intents and purposes to her, an animal.
Or an alien. Yeah, and as good as she is, she doesn't quite convince us of that, obviously.
She comes close. Like you said, the end of the movie is so much better. The last act is by far the
partly best part of the film. Partly because it's Pan's Labyrinth all over again.
Yeah, yeah, that's when it does start to and have a Stubart lot of more similarities.
And has that brutal death, the fingers on. Maybe the most disgusting. That's a really
I kind of loved the fingers. Moment. That was like a nice metaphor for his rotting soul.
Yeah. And pretty realistic because they managed to reattach them, but bodies don't always accept organs being put back on, or organs. But anyway, you know what I'm saying here.
Then they have the whole thing, too, where he's taking the pain medication. Along with the tonal inconsistency, there's just way too much going on in the film.
Last actor I want to talk about is a guy that we indirectly know, and he's a good friend of Andrei Bajelic,
who was friend on of the our, podcast.
He was on Cube and also briefly on A Clockwork Orange. David Hewlett, who's Fleming, he is Strickland's, I guess, second in command.
Yeah, he's a friend of a friend, but I don't think right. either of us have ever met him.
It's been a ton of movies. He was also in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and a movie that people who are not Canadian probably have never heard of.
Yeah.
But Treat Murray, I thought was pretty solid, yeah. too.
He's one of those Canadian actors that if you know anything about Canadian film, you would definitely know who this guy is. And he's also one of those actors that anytime somebody shoots a movie in Canada, there's an obligation to cast a certain number of Canadians in your film. So they'll cast their stars, and then a lot of these smaller players will go to Canadian actors. David Hewlett is one of those you see all the time. If you're a Canadian, you're looking out for him. Another one is Colm Feore. You see him in lots of movies. He's like the token Canadian because he's a great character.
He's become
actor.
A star in our country.
I love Colm Feore. I have since before Hollywood discovered him when he was just a star in Canada. Molly Parker is another good one. You see her in lots of movies for that purpose. But they get cast because they're wonderful as well.
Easy when you make a Jim Carrey or Michael J. Fox. Maybe not so much him now, but Jim Carrey, Michael J. Fox. I can't think of other Canadian actors right now. Why can't I?
You can do better than that.
Donald Sutherland isn't he Canadian?
Ryan Gosling, Ryan Reynolds.
Sure. So Del Toro, of course, did Pan's Labyrinth. We said that a lot. But also The Devil's Backbone, which is a really tough foreign language film. As many people have said, his foreign language films generally tend to be better than his American ones. Although Blade 2 I enjoyed. Not as much when I saw it the second time. Still liked it, but a little less. Not a huge fan of the first Hellboy. Liked the second one more for some reason. Maybe because it's even goofier and funnier. But that's a pretty good resume. He loves his monsters. I think he even talked about that during his Best Picture acceptance speech. He did two speeches, so I'm probably blending picture and director here. And his buddy Iñárritu convinced him to make this movie. Del Toro said if the film flopped, he would have quit. As if to say, if you guys can accept this, then I'm fucking out of here. Which is really strong way like to feel about that.
I bet a lot of directors make empty threats like
Look at the actors.
That's an artist thing to say.
Look at Sean Penn, Anthony Hopkins, and now it's Daniel Day-Lewis. I'm quitting acting. And they all come back. Maybe not Day-Lewis. He hasn't had a chance to really be gone yet, but anyway.
My notes to Sean Penn saying he's never coming back. Wait, don't go.
Del Toro loves his monsters. This should have been a Universal picture because they're known for their monsters back in the 30s. Including The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which was the 50s, but that's one of their movies, too.
And he was inspired by The Creature from the Black Lagoon. He was really moved by that movie, and he wanted the creature to get the girl in the end, and originally pitched this like a total remake of The Creature from the Black Lagoon, only he gets the girl at the end, and the studios were like, no, thanks. Then he reworked it into this from the girl's perspective.
I was watching Jaws a few nights ago, and that's got a lot of comparisons to Creature from the Black Lagoon as well.
Yeah, this shark does get the girl at the end of Jaws, too.
Well, the beginning of the movie. Some of the shots, though, when that scene is happening, the very beginning, are very similar. And I think Spielberg even admitted that he cribbed them from Creature from the Black Lagoon. Del Toro wrote lengthy backstories for the characters. If I was a director or a writer, I guess I have to be a director because the writer wouldn't have this kind of power, but that's something I would do. And if they didn't want to use it, they didn't have to use it, but at least I would know what's really going on with these characters.
In any good movie, the writer, director, and definitely the actor are doing that. That's how you get an authentic
I think actors do that for themselves a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think that's like the homework they do, right? Yeah.
And the producers were Del Toro. Of course, he won Best Picture, so he had to be a producer. And J. Miles Dale, who did Harold and Kumar, Go to White Castle, and also Mama, which was a produced movie by Del Toro. What a resume that is for him. The movie's 185-1. We watched the DVD from the library, like I said, the Toronto Public Library. Thank you for that. Cinematographer Dan Lauston, I said his name wrong in the podcast that we did for the Oscars a couple months ago, and I did it again probably. The editor, Sidney Walensky, has only cut 9 movies, including Howard the Duck. I love looking for those weird ones. And the composer, who won an Oscar, his second, Alexander Desplat, He won for Grand Budapest Hotel as well, and also did the music for The King's Speech and Argo. So he's been involved in at least, maybe it's more, but three Best Picture winners, all fairly recently. There's been some pretty good Best Picture winners in the last 10 or so years, but a lot of movies that, whether you like them or not, are not going to be thought of at Casablanca's level, or Cuckoo's Nest, or Schindler's List.
And a lot of movies where we're going to feel years from now like they got robbed, that will have the cultural impact years from now. People will remember them. Certainly this year is no exception. I can think of at least three movies off the top of my head that I think deserve Best Picture.
This year meaning 2017,
meaning though. 2017.
Because it was the awards for this year.
Yeah.
That was the other thing about this. We talked about it again in the preview show this year. Some of the other movies that were nominated for Best Picture were weak or okay or just flat out crappy. We
even
didn't think
the other frontrunner, Three Billboards, which we liked, but
we had major problems with.
If it had won Best Picture, I think we would be doing this podcast about Three Billboards. I think I like that better than Shape of Water, but
I did too.
There was tons of problems with it.
The performances were awesome. There were some great moments in it, but I had real problems with the story.
And it looked kind of like shit, and it just kind of meandered tangents and stuff, and it was a good film. There's lots to like about it. But I'm really surprised that those were the two dominating movies at the Oscars and the Globes.
Well, here are the ones I think were weak choices for Best Picture just being nominees. The Post, Phantom Thread, Dunkirk, and I really hated Darkest Hour. I haven't seen any of them a second time. Phantom Thread, I feel like I might like it more when I see it again. That's happened before with PTA when I saw Magnolia. I went from not liking it all to thinking it was great. So maybe I'll think that about this one. But I don't think that about The Post, Dunkirk, or Darkest Hour. Especially not Post and the really shitty Darkest Hour.
I feel like Dunkirk is the one that I might go back to and get more out of. Because if I were to go into that movie not wanting it to make sense, and just wanting to experience the immersion and the beauty of it, because it's such a beautiful film. I'm thrilled that Roger Deakins won an Oscar for Blade Runner 2049, which is a beautiful film and absolutely deserved it.
And he should have won a long time ago.
Yes, and Deakins was way overdue, but it's a crime that those two movies had to be competing against each other because Dunkirk was so beautiful that no matter who won, somebody would feel like they were robbed.
That happens every year, though. Somebody gets robbed, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
We said in The Dark Knight a few weeks ago that the Oscar snub for Best Picture didn't get one. Probably helped non-traditional movies like this one later on go on to get nominated or even to win. We've seen a few animated movies get nominated since 2008. Well, 2009, I guess, really. That was the first year that it could have been more than five nominees, and it's usually been, I don't know if it's ever been 10. It's rarely been 10 nominees. That's the most it could be. That opens up the field. It also means that you've got people being in so many movies that are nominated for Best Picture, like an actress from Blockers. But then also means that they are putting in stuff like The Post that would get nowhere near it if it weren't for the fact that there are that many openings.
I wish instead of opening it up to 10 nominees, opening up for films like The Post, which are so banal, and instead rewarding fringy movies that were probably the best movies of the year. I'm thinking of Florida Project, which was almost entirely overlooked.
I can't wait to see that again. I haven't yet.
Willem Dafoe got it. Oh, that's right. He did. Such a wonderful movie, but wasn't on the radar because it was an independent film, but better than most of the films on the nominations list. Mm. So I wish that those were the films that were getting attention rather than Spielberg's latest,
again,
not even close to his best.
But then Dark Knight is fantasy in some ways, and this, of course, is a fantasy movie, obviously. Maybe it doesn't get nominated at all if it weren't for the fact that Dark Knight, it wasn't just about The Dark Knight in 2008. It was also about WALL-E. It was also about people saying, we can market more movies if we have more nominees. I think there was just a perfect storm of events. But The Dark Knight was the main reason why they opened it up to so many movies.
They're stumbling their way towards making things better, because I actually think that the Oscars is improving, but it's a very slow-turning ship. It's an ocean liner.
Get Out wouldn't have been nominated in previous years.
Not a chance.
And it actually won an award, which maybe it would have been nominated for the screenplay that it got nominated for, but it wouldn't have been nominated for Picture and Director many years ago.
And it is, in my opinion, one of the best films of the year. One of the few films nominated for Best Picture that truly deserved it.
Well, it's only been a few months since we saw these movies. Obviously, it hasn't even been a year. Well, it's been more than a year since we first saw Get Out, because that was last
February. Well, we've seen it a second time since.
Right. Yeah. So a year and a half-ish for all these movies at the most, I guess, since we saw any of them, and less than that for most of them. But the ones that might stand out the most will be Get Out and Call Me By Your Name, which I know you loved an awful lot.
Yeah.
For various reasons, and Three Billboards too, for the performances at the very least, and that great surprise with Woody Harrelson. I won't give it away because people maybe still haven't seen it, although I suppose we always ruin movies, don't we? But I didn't see what happens to him coming.
If we weren't going to do this podcast, I never would have rewatched Shape of Water.
Oh, hell
no. I would never bother watching it
because
again.
We were underwhelmed. That's why it doesn't fit in this month, but we wanted to cover the Best Picture winner like we did last year when we did Moonlight.
It just felt
which
nothing.
We were very whelmed by.
Yes. Three Billboards I intend to watch again someday. It's just such a fun movie. It was more entertaining to me than Shape of Water.
When we talked about our favorites from this year in the Oscars preview show, I mentioned Three Billboards because of those great performances and some of those script elements and some of the better things in it. Okay, the influence of The Shape of Water and from other movies on The Shape of Water, of course, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and as I've said a few times already, Splash, which I think is really its cousin even more so maybe than Pan's Labyrinth. It is Splash and Pan's Labyrinth, I guess, merged together into this movie that won awards that those ones didn't, the big ones. And that dance scene homages Rodgers and Asterflex very deliberately, but one in particular called Follow the Fleet. And more, I think it's not really an influence, but there's an unrelated documentary with the same name, The Shape of Water, that they did in 2006, and it's narrated by Susan Sarandon. It has nothing What's to do about? With any... I don't know, but it just is called The Shape of Water.
Huh.
So maybe watch that too. Compare them for no good reason. All right, last thoughts on The Fish Fucker.
I didn't hate The Fish Fucker, but I cannot account for why so many people forgave its shortcomings.
And wept watching it, I guess, too.
Yeah. There were so many other films in 2018 that were also beautiful and original and moving and exhilarating, but managed to stay tonally consistent and hit their mark. I'm thinking of Get Out, Call Me By Your Name, The Florida Project, Lady Bird, Blade Runner 2049, and even, I'll say it again,
Mother,
that's right. At any rate, I wasn't offended by Shape of Water so much as I was offended by winning Best Picture, if it had just been treated like the simply good film that it is rather than a great film. I probably wouldn't have any animosity towards it at all.
But even our 3 stars or thumb up review, whatever you want to call it, is a very guarded one, regardless of Best Picture.
I would be pretty hesitant to recommend it to people, honestly.
Mm. Well, when the red letter scenes are scenes you have issues with, I don't know if you have as many issues as I do, but yes, it's beautiful, but it's also fucking stupid.
I couldn't get over it. I didn't buy into it.
They don't belong together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's not a movie we hated, but here comes one that we did, at least I did. So when we plug back into the internet in 7 days, we'll continue Movies We Hate Month with the loathsome, non-ROM, non-COM, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. Now, I chose this, and I'll talk more about this next week, over a lot of other undoubtedly worse movies. But because the one after that we're going to do, we'll say right now, is Avatar. And we've watched all the movies this month. We watched them quite a while ago, during our vacation, as it turns out. That's a lot of things, but it's just kind of a sci-fi action film. I wanted to go the other way and go with a rom-com, because I've hated so many of them. When they're done right, great. When they're not... But anyway, we'll talk more about that next week. I, by the way, could have chosen that same year, Bad Boys 2, which is a movie I fucking loathe. But anyway, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. So, the coming attraction trivia for that movie. Matthew McConaughey has had a pretty long career now, and the quality of his movies has been all over the place. His highest ranked film on Rotten Tomatoes is Mud at 97%, and his lowest ranked is Surfer Dude at 0%. So here's an opinion question.
All right.
Which is your favorite of his movies that had a Rotten Tomato? And which is your least favorite Matthew McConaughey movie that had a fresh tomato? So a movie that they didn't like, that you did, and a movie that they liked, that you didn't.
So, listeners, let us know what you think. You can tweet us at BevEllisEllis, or Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can email us, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com, and then tune in for the answer, our answer to that question, on our next podcast about How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. But what if you just can't wait until then? Well, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project. We're on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 250 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Perhaps in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. And once more, before we go, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive. So is this the part where we jump into the sea, Ryan?
I'll save you, baby. Make sure your gills work. The scars on your neck, they're gills.
So romantic. And cut.